tell you this. He received his PhD in political science from Yale University. He has taught at a number of colleges, universities in the United States and abroad. Some of his writings have been translated into Arabic, Bangla, Chinese, Dutch, French, German, Greek, Italian, Japanese, Korean. You've seen some of these amazing books. Among his books are included The Face of Imperialism, God and His Demons, Democracy for the Few, Contrary Notions, the Michael Parenti Reader, Democracy for the Few, an amazing book, The Culture Struggle, Super Patriotism, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, The Terrorism Trap, To Kill a Nation, History as Mystery, America Besieged, Black Shirts and Reds, Dirty Truth, Against Empire, Inventing Reality. They go on and on. Well, he's written a beautiful memoir. I was there to introduce him, hear his speech, and find out a lot more about the person in Michael Parenti. So let's see if we can go to me and then him.
It is an honor to be here to introduce Michael Parenti, Dr. Michael Parenti's new book. I couldn't believe this, but Michael told me he's going to be 80 on Monday. I thought he was going to do 60. I feel 10 years older than he does, I'm sure. Let me start off by telling you what some other people think of Michael Parenti, and then I'll tell you what I think of him. So Michael Parenti is an internationally known, award-winning author and lecturer. He is one of the nation's leading progressive political analysts, my favorite. His highly informative and entertaining books and talks have reached a wide range of audiences in North America and abroad. And I have said this to Michael before, but I want to say it again. Michael is a wonderful spirit. And he's a wonderful writer. He writes beautiful prose. Sometimes he writes about very heavy subjects that are based in economic thought. But the beauty is he's a translator for us. And he has that ability, as such a fine writer, to be our translator so that we can understand things that oftentimes are written for us not to be able to understand. And I really appreciate that about Michael Parenti. And the other thing that I really appreciate about Michael is that he's a wonderful writer, radical political analyst, but he's out there on the front lines. Most of the people I work with, I never see him at demonstrations, at actions. Michael, I think I met Michael in the middle of a mass arrest. I think this was, I might be mixing up my dates, but I think it was 2003 when we were about to bomb Iraq again. And there was a street protest, and we were marching, and we got cornered down one block. And we were all about to get arrested. I don't know if you remember this, Michael, and some woman opened up her apartment, and about 30 of us went in. But the point I'm making is that I've often seen Michael at actions. He does put his body where his beliefs are. And that is really unusual. I appreciate that very much. I want to tell you a few things that people said about his new book, which I'm only just starting, but it's wonderful. Again, those beautiful prose. This one's a little bit more personal, but it's lovely. The book is called Waiting for Yesterday. And here's what some folks have said. Michael Parenti's poignant and wonderfully written memoir proves that nostalgia in the right hands, such as his, can be a liberating force. This book is a remarkable combination of the personal and political, a brave, honest memoir, and a provocative social analysis presented in a captivating way. Yeah, I agree with all that. I am honored and proud to present to you Dr. Michael Parenti.
I deny it. But you know, it's nice when you know your friends, you know how nice your friends, how much your friends like you when they're willing, they say, 80, they act astonished. 80, I thought you were like, 72 or 59 or 60. You know, and I think, you know, and they're willing to assure you that way. You know, you know that they like you, they care about your feelings, and they don't want to say, oh my God, that's terrible, I'm shocked. Why don't you call it quits and all that? Well, I have a problem with this book. I have never talked about it, and I don't know how exactly. Let me just tell you, before I talk about this memoir, allow me a word about memoirs in general, okay? In the days of yore, memoirs were the province of famous celebrities or well-placed people, gentry, and that sort of thing. They were often called meditations, life passages, confessions. You know, we know the two famous ones, Confessions of St. Augustine, which I've read because I had to write God and His Demons. And Rousseau's Confessions, which I haven't read. I wanted to read. I hear it's really kinky, and I just wanted to. I have never gotten around to it. Essays, you know, there was Michel de Montaigne with his essays back in the 16th century and all that. In later generations, by the mid-20th century, ordinary people were writing some. I mean, the books were still coming out from illustrious or celebrities and prominent political figures going into retirement and such. But many commoners also were writing books about uncommon experiences. The first one to climb a major mountain, fighting in trench warfare in World War I. I used to read a number of trench warfare books during World War II. There wasn't the literature yet, because World War II was just going on, and it hadn't started yet. But the old literature from World War I, they started dusting it up and bringing all these books out to the library, and I would read these things about the fights and all that, and the trenches and such. Today we witness an explosion of memoirs by everybody and their wives and offspring. One week in the Sunday New York Times bestseller list of the 20 non-fiction paperbacks, of the 20, I counted 14 that were memoirs or personal experience accounts. Lost in the woods for a week and had to drink my own urine, you know, those kind of... No, I'm quoting what would have been a theme. Those of you who are just coming in and out with attention, don't say, what Parenti drank is... Okay, it was a book. I'm referring to a book in the New York Times. Nursed a friend through a difficult pregnancy, how I lost my fear of heights, my life as a twin. There was one like that. It was called Twin. You know what? There are memoirs being written today in great numbers by people who are, excuse me, but by people who are in their 20s. I don't know. And they're very heavy. They're very heavy on high school and cheerleader tryouts and loss of virginity. Those are the big things in the 20-year-old memoirs. You don't have that much perspective when you're in your 20s about, you know, the whole thing in life there. Okay. Well, I'm of two minds regarding the memoir explosion. By the way, in the racket, in the publishing racket, they're called memoirs. You know, memoirs. Oh, me. First, I'm of two minds. Here's the first one, the one I'm just putting out right now, which is there seem to be just too many memoirs, you know. I'll quote Neil Genslinger in the New York Times. He did a very funny review. And he said, that you had parents and a childhood does not of itself qualify you to write a memoir. You know, siblings, conflicts, reconciliations, all siblings have that. Avoid the, this is Genslinger again. He said, avoid the, if it happened to me, it must be interesting, fallacy. He said, if your mother was a little odd, everybody's mother was a little odd. Your father was often remote and couldn't relate that well. Oh, come on, give me a break. It's boku families like that. But, you get a divorce or a breakup in a relationship. Big deal. Everybody gets a divorce. What else is there to do? Genslinger called them oversharers. They're just sharing too much of it. But I said I was of two minds, and my second mind is I actually welcome the stories by many ordinary people. I listened to the Moth theater thing on sometimes. Ira Glass, when he doesn't get too trivial, some of his stories are sort of interesting. And many ordinary people have compelling stories, maybe not their whole life or something, but of certain unusual incidents of that sort. And ordinary lives can be full of struggle, valor, deception, inventiveness, interesting incidents, courage, you know. In any case, they're more interesting than media personalities and their ego-ridden enterprises. I mean, fiction authors, screenwriters, actors, producers, all those people, NPR just doesn't let go of them. You can just go right down the dial, and they're one after another being interviewed, you know. Oh, yes, and then I met Joe Daniels in Vegas, and he got me my first job at the this and this, and then that's when we formed our group, and blah, blah, and I'm sitting there saying, oh, God, people got to be very hungry for very strange stuff. Let's bring out the guy who drinks his urine. Jeez. Well, all of this is really just a sympathy wind-up because in the book, I deal with the family, of course. It's really an ethnic memoir to a large degree, not completely, but, and I deal with other ethnic groups, too, to some degree. The family, the community, which is East Harlem in New York City. East Harlem is in Manhattan, not out on Long Island, not in Brooklyn. So far, two commentators have said that. But its eastern border is the East River, and the north border is the Harlem River. So it's right there, just below the Bronx. And East Harlem was a community of about 90,000 Italian Americans. It was the largest Italian community in the United States, 90,000. Today, it doesn't exist anymore. It's gone, and it's all been turned into huge projects, you know, big project with elevators and 12-floor buildings and no place for kids to play. When that was starting to come up on 3rd Avenue, one little block of it, I remember looking as a kid, looking at it with dread. I mean, real feeling of dread. There was no place to hide or play or climb or run or jump or anything like that. So the community, this is about school. School was sort of like a better wash concentration camp. I mean, I talk about it and all this way. You found that you couldn't. Well, I'll read something from that. The street was a big thing. Religion. I wrote about three chapters on religion, and religion. It was a good case. I said, "Oh, do I want to put stuff on religion?" And this often happens with writers. Not always, but. Where you sometimes write something that you feel you have to write, you see. And it turns out to be the good. It's like one of your strongest parts of whatever the article or book is that you're writing. And the religious selections are pretty good. One chapter, the title of the chapter is Jesus Was a Roman Catholic. And I made that conclusion from a prayer that we said in Holy Rosary Church with the priest and all that, and Blessed Jesus. And God made us to show forth his goodness and share with us his everlasting happiness in heaven. This is a prayer we learn. Who teaches us to know, love, and serve God? Jesus Christ, the Son of God, teaches us through the Roman Catholic Church. And then I put in italics, through the Roman Catholic Church. No doubt about it. Jesus was a Roman Catholic. I was on the winning team. You know? I have another chapter called My First Protestant. And he was my first real-life Protestant. Everybody in East Harlem was Catholic or Jew. And along comes this guy, right out of a picture book. He had a big Adam's apple, you know, and that kind of, and he talked about Jesus. I mean, Jesus had a syllable of five syllables, Jesus. And he had a little suitcase with a flag, an American flag on it. I don't know what the hell they do with an American flag, but Jesus was a patriot. And he had these Bibles, and the Bibles had beautiful illustrations in them, beautiful. And I wanted, and I stood there, and I was listening to him. I approached him, and I told him I wanted to read his Bible. And it had all these, and he said enthusiastically, "Will you read this Bible if I give it to you, boy?" I said, "Yes," I exclaim. "God wrote this himself, son." I said, "Wonderful. I had no idea God wrote books." "Will you read God's words?" "Yeah, sure." By now we were both shouting with excitement. "Then this great good book is yours." And he placed the Bible in my hands, and I went, walk, and I started to thank him, and he said, "Don't thank me, son. Thank Jesus." And I went to my priest, and the priest told me to throw it in the ash can after he looked through it. He said, "It's a Protestant Bible, Parenti. It's all," I got that in here. He said, "Stay away from Protestants. It should, they don't give it, all they do is give us trouble." And that was that. I mean, that's what I love about religion, is the love that everybody has. The love, the religion teaches us how to love, you know. You people don't have religion, you're full of hatred, but we have love. We burn people at the stake, but we do it lovingly, we feel pity for them. And I have a chapter, there's one chapter with a title called Living with Mussolini, and that was just how fascism really tore up some communities and families, generationally, whatever else. I have two chapters, one called How Italy Won World War I, and the other was called How Italy Won World War II, and I mean it. I'm serious. And you'll find out it was true about World War I. They beat the Austrian and German divisions and drove them back to Veneto. After Caporetto, they were shattered. And what everybody remembers is Caporetto. I remember when you used to say, "Oh, he met his Caporetto," like he met his Waterloo. Remember that? Nobody says Caporetto anymore. Waterloo has survived 200 years, but Caporetto was just that generation that drank martinis and listened to Cole Porter music. I mean, who has taste, you know? And the Italian army really regrouped.